You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we love to tell their stories. Hot Bread Kitchen is a nonprofit, multi-ethnic bakery and job training program out of Manhattan, whose range of international breads are as impressive as they are authentic. Learn more at hotbreadkitchen.org or visit one of our six Manhattan locations for a taste.
Well, here we are. It's Sunday, right after Thanksgiving. We have Nicole Taylor, the famous Nicole Taylor, host of Hot Grease, is going to be a guest today. And how's it going, Jack? How was your Thanksgiving?
It's good, man. Really good.
What did you do? Did you overcook the turkey?
I have to properly introduce myself. Hold on. Oh, okay. There we go. That's better. we had a really awesome, about a 9-pound Heritage turkey from you guys. Thank mm-hmm. you very much. And I have to call my mom and my family out here because it's like the very thing we fight against at this network. You know, we had six people for Thanksgiving with a 9-pound turkey, which should be plenty. And she found the need to go to the grocery store and buy another commodity turkey breast because she wanted more and leftovers. And of course, the Heritage turkey was enough and there was this whole breast that was wasted, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. It was the higher the quality of the food, the further it goes, you know. Like people like at our Heritage meat shop, they see $28 a pound for prosciutto and then they only need like 0.2 of a pound,
right?
You know, so they end up spending like $3.98 and it feeds like 8 people an appetizer. It's really interesting what we view as like large amounts, you know, quantity versus quality. But so this is a short week on radio, right?
Yeah, right into the week in review. And kind of speaking of that theme, Mitchell Davis spoke about leftovers on his show on Wednesday.
What did he say were good leftovers?
He said one of the most challenging ones is pasta because people have differing opinions on how to cook leftover pasta. Do you keep the sauce separate? Do you keep it with the sauce and all this other stuff? But I mean, what are some of your favorite things to do with?
So Mitchell Davis is the author of, he's the host of Taste Matters, right? Which broadcasts on Wednesdays at 11.
Yes.
And, he was talking all about leftovers. Who was his guest to talk about such a topic?
Looking right now, his guest was,
because leftovers is a really interesting, I guess I don't like leftovers. Nicole, how do you feel about leftovers?
I can take like one day of leftovers.
Do you eat anything like Chinese food, pizza? I mean, can it be anything?
Any leftovers, I can do it for one day only.
Mm, interesting.
I actually just don't like eating more of the same food, I think. Now, pasta is an exception because you can fry it and it gets end up being super crispy and super good. But pizza's better, I think, the next day sometimes. But anyway, yeah, I'm not a big leftovers fan. I was joking with Ann's family, and they never ate leftovers. Or no, who was it? Larry Sorrell's family. They have 8 kids, and they never had leftovers with 8 kids. So it ended up being a weird thing for them, too. But
I feel like only in America do we prepare for leftovers, though, you know?
Yeah, like that's really what you were saying with your mother, right? Yep. Buying the extra breasts.
Exactly.
So who else was on this week? So there were no Thursday shows, I take it, or did you come in Thursday to do Taste of the Past?
No, I didn't. No, thankfully I was home on Thursday. But yeah, we had a show, a Great Beer Sessions episode, where they brought in a bunch of vintage beers, some of them from the 70s. It was from Ray Dieter's personal collection. His wife was nice enough to give the guys some of those beers for the holiday beer session. So it was nice to kind of remember Ray. And they also had a kind of cool discussion on vintage beers, because not many people realize that beers can be aged like wine, you know?
Interesting. Did these beers have cork in them?
Yes. Some did, some didn't.
Oh, really? So you can still age a beer even if it doesn't have a cork?
Yeah, I'm going to play a clip from the show right now.
Huh. Well, it's like wine. You know, certain wines are built for aging and certain wines are not built for the same kind of aging. You have to understand what properties you're looking at that have the potential for that.
Yeah, and also the storage temperature, how frequently you move it.
Of course.
And I see people with regular crown caps, which is the standard opener cap, and they lay them down on their side. You cannot do that because it'll pick up a metallic taste.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was interesting. I got to taste one of those beers from the 70s, too, and I'll say it tasted like cigar in the best way possible.
Interesting. Now, it's just so funny. I didn't think things could age, really, if they were just in a hermetically sealed bottle. But I guess they can, right?
Yeah.
They get better. Do they get, like, looser?
Yeah, the carbonation definitely goes away. It's got more of a molasses syrupy kind of feel to it.
But so I heard there was another Mind Kitchen. Now, has that aired yet? Not yet.
Yes.
Right?
The Mind Kitchen goes live now. It's the Matt and Rachel show.
Right.
And sometimes they do a Mind Kitchen. And our very own Ann Sachs will be in Sophie Schlesinger 1, the Mind Kitchen.
And now, what did they have to do? They had to improv something.
Yes. So the Mind Kitchen here is it's a game invented by Matt Timms. He gives you 5 ingredients. You have to come up with a 3-course meal in your mind using a bare bones kitchen. So the 5 ingredients he gave.
Chicken was one, right?
Yeah. It was potatoes, iceberg lettuce, chicken, carrots, and cheddar cheese.
Oh my God! So, yes. What was the tip? What clip are you about to play? Was it the tipping point that made Ann win?
Yeah. Well, Scott first. Rachel went. She had. I don't remember her dish. But Scott Gold did a chicken inside of a chicken inside of a chicken, like a turducken, but with all chicken. Thrice chicken. And then here's Ann explaining her dish, followed by Matt announcing the winner.
All right, so Team Cheese over here, you know, being cheese-centric, we decided that we were going to incorporate cheese into every part of our dish.
Yeah.
And there are so many tie-ins, actually. Okay, because you gave us boring ingredients.
Yeah.
So we were thinking, what is the most boring cuisine in the world? And it's probably British cuisine.
Oh, and they would hate you for that. They're all talking about how proud they are these days.
I know.
Cuisine,
well, it's gotten,
does suck.
It maybe has gotten better, and that might be true. But, you know, traditionally known as being very bad. And so we took it like, you know, Gulliver's Travels, like back in time style. And we are cooking for people, for a huge horde of people at the height of the British Empire.
Like
maybe around like 1830.
Good. You're throwing a party.
Like medieval feast.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thousands of people.
But I will say that you found your way to my heart by talking about Britain and frying chicken and eating French fries. Because that's normal stuff, but yum,
oh my God,
right?
French fries.
Anywho, that's why you guys just won. What did you win?
Yeah, well, there you go.
What did they win?
Nothing.
And how is the Matt and Rachel show? How are they going? Because they had each had individual shows, right? She had an edible Brooklyn one.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a happy medium between the two.
They get along?
Yeah, we did have to make fun of Matt on air, though, because he came here bragging about getting a gig with McDonald's for a commercial. So we had to kind of set him in his place.
What does that mean? He wrote it?
No, he's like the radio voice for a commercial.
Really?
It was actually a Thanksgiving commercial from McDonald's where they're selling like a 50-piece of nuggets as a Thanksgiving meal. It was pretty disgusting.
50-piece of nuggets. Well, in the old days, you know, people used to cater their weddings with McDonald's. You know, it was like a new phenomenon. But anyway, and so, well, that's interesting. Well, congratulations to Ann Sachs. We'll be cutting the curd. now, what's his last one? This last one on the Week in Review sounds very, very troubling.
Yeah, the counterfeiting. So on Unfiltered, Brian DeMarco had his friend Justin on, and they were talking about a big problem in China where they're counterfeiting labels of wine, you know, filling it obviously with other wine, then re-exporting it out. So it seems like this is not too uncommon in China with other things as well. I mean, we've covered the honey thing in China on this network as well, where they're, you know, it's not even real honey, some other product, and they're labeling it as honey and sending it back to us. So definitely.
And did they
troubling.
Talk about how it's like being kind of regulated or anything like that?
Well, yeah, they're just kind of figuring these things out, so I'm not sure about the regulation, but we do know it's a problem.
It's funny, because, I mean, you know, American companies rip off names and terms all the time, you know, and that's okay because they're seeking profits. They're businessmen, you know? And
true.
Then, you know, when it happens in China, everyone's like, that's outrageous.
Yeah.
Well, very interesting. So, yeah, it was a short week, but, you know, good job doing the week in review. Anything else, Jack?
Yeah, well, Beer Fest, that's what's else.
Oh, really? What else? Well, tell us.
Next Sunday, Roberta's is hosting Beer Fest, the second annual Beer Fest.
A big industry party last year, and we're competing, right?
Yes.
They have been very happy to know that they've done away with the tricycle relay race.
Thank God.
It's now a wheelbarrow race, and that's a lot easier. Jack, you know, as the founder of the station, I will be driving the wheelbarrow. You will have to be in it. I hope that's okay.
I'm skinny. I'm light. It's okay. It should be good.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a short break, and we will come back with the great Nicole Taylor of Hot Grease. And I didn't know what to do. You packed all your things and gave me your ring. Said, honey, I'm leaving for good. All right. Well, welcome into the studio. Did you have any trouble finding the place, Nicole?
Ha. No. It's a Sunday, and it's really crowded here. No problems.
Good, good. So give us major headlines, Thanksgiving. What did you do?
Oh, what did I do?
You didn't do gravy, right? You did dressing.
Oh, man. I had a disaster. I actually had two disasters. One, I was able to cover up. So I got a 9-pound Heritage turkey. And for folks who are listening, if you cook the Heritage turkey, you know you don't get all that funky mucus and fat, which is a good thing. But my gravy was a fail, Patrick.
What happened? Where did you go wrong?
I needed more fat.
So anyway, turkeys, heritage birds don't give as much fat.
Exactly. So I thought I remembered that last year. So anyway, no gravy. Oh, well.
So now, and then you made traditional, like, stuffing.
So you mentioned stuffing. I made dressing.
Dressing instead, all together, no stuffing.
Yes. The difference between dressing, I talked about that on my last show. Dressing has eggs, so it's more, it's like together, almost like a casserole. Same ingredients, but together. So I made dressing, pecan sage dressing. I used Etna Lewis's recipe.
Mm-hmm.
I made homemade cranberry ginger sauce, braised collard greens.
Mm-hmm.
What else did I have? Oh, I made two sweet potato bourbon pies.
Mm.
I used King County's bourbon. And like this cream cheese pie with like a cranberry sauce on top. It was a great Thanksgiving.
And you do all the cooking? Everyone else is out of the kitchen?
I did all the cooking. Oh, yeah. I made a gratin, which everyone, you know, it's like it tastes like mac and cheese. I made a root vegetable gratin.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
So now you had a heritage bird for Thanksgiving. Do you recommend to your friends and peers and colleagues like, hey, get heritage, or are you just like, get a locally raised broad-breasted white?
Oh, hell no. Hell no, I wouldn't tell anyone to get a butterball or whatever. I would say with hands down, without a doubt, to get a heritage turkey. It's once a year. I mean, to spend a few extra dollars once a year, What's the big deal? I feel like you can kind of skim back on some other things and buy a heritage bird. The flavor is great. You don't have to do a lot. You don't have to brine. Mm-hmm. You just basically do a great butter rub, and you're getting like delicious, healthy meat.
It's interesting. There was an article in today's New York Times Sunday Magazine, New York Times, and it had a picture of a bulldog on it. and it showed all the problems wrong with that bulldog. It was a big face of a bulldog, and it showed his tooth was off, and it showed his eye couldn't see. He had arthritis, and it was like literally the cover was 50 things. And then I read one of their big captions in the article, and they said that worse than puppy mills and worse than like pit bull dog fighting is the kind of inbreeding that is going on. It's actually worse for dogs, the inbreeding that goes on, the genetic manipulation for a look or for a certain trait, like a large amounts of white breast meat. So it's just interesting to think that genetic manipulation is actually the cruelest form of animal treatment.
Yeah. Hey, folks, who wants a artificially inseminated turkey?
So, yeah, no, it's true. I mean, they should have sex, right, if they're going to
die. Pretty much.
Now, let me ask. I don't know the right way to phrase this question, but, you know, Kim Severson wrote an article this Thanksgiving saying, you know, absolutely heritage is not worth it by, a broad-breasted white. You know, Michael Pollan has said to me, you know, personally a few times, you know, well, yours is an elitist movement, you know, and that is separate from, you know, what he's trying to do. And it's always stuck to me why, you know, certain people should be told or it should be believed that the quality shouldn't have access to it, or it's just too expensive in the first place to even consider, when, you know, sometimes it's universally agreed upon that it's the best tasting food. You know, like if it's the best turkey in the country, why would you tell certain people, oh, it's not the best, it's a waste of money? Like, how do you feel about this whole elitist argument, you know, and what it means to quality and food access?
So I did go home over the weekend and read the little blog entry on New York Times Dining that Kim Severson wrote. I'm a fan of Kim Severson. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love all her writing.
She's
I love
based
her book.
In Atlanta.
She's based in ATL. She's doing a lot of great stories about Atlanta and the South in general. Mm-hmm. I think what she said in the article, she was trying to make good meat accessible to people. So she kind of didn't say anything or made, you know, one sentence comment about the heritage turkey and saying, oh, yeah, you don't really need that. So I see that she was trying to make it more accessible. Michael Pollan, I'm going to say it on air. Sorry, I am not a fan of Michael Pollan. This is probably the first time publicly I've said this, but I'll say I'm not a fan. He is teaching a class at UC Berkeley with Nikki Henderson, who's the executive director of the People's Grocery, and a few other people. And you can actually watch online the lectures. And so they were talking about food access, and Michael Pollan does not feel that there's a structural problem in terms of food access, meaning that poor people or disadvantaged people make choices, and that it's not about elitism, that folks have a choice and they can make a choice if they want to buy a heritage turkey. I completely disagree. And I think even him having that attitude sets the tone for him to be an elitist person in the food world. Mm-hmm. To believe.
So describe, break it down. So what is he saying and why do you disagree?
He is saying that if you live in, say, for instance, my neighborhood, Bed-Stuy, that there is not a structural reason why none of the grocery stores have a heritage turkey, or you can go to one of the corner markets and buy organic fruit or flour that may come from King Arthur. Mm-hmm. He's saying that that's
structural. You mean like distribution, things like about
distribution
nature?
Policy. When I say structure, that's what I mean. The people who are making the decisions. He's saying that that doesn't exist. I completely disagree. And
what do you think it is?
I think that it is. It's all about the structural things. I mean, Whole Foods is not going to come to. I love Whole Foods, but
it's not going to open in Bed-Stuy, for instance.
Exactly. It's not going to open in Bed-Stuy unless they see that the income is there.
So is he creating a kind of all things are equal and it's just a choice thing versus
Correct.
Saying that there could be everything from institutionalized prejudice all the way down to just like people deciding against
his readings,
food.
His comments over the years suggest, in my opinion, a very elitist view of you can make your own choices. I don't care if your neighborhood is full of McDonald's and you have the highest concentration of fast food spots in the nation. He discounts that. And I think that that's not fair. If you walk every day by KFC and all these other places, I mean, what do you expect? Mm-hmm. That's what you're going to eat. And then if you don't have other choices in your neighborhood, to me, it's all about structural, the system.
Yeah, infrastructure. Yeah, and the people. And we'll talk a little bit about Occupy Wall Street in a bit. But, you know, the whole thing is... Yeah, if someone's poor, they should also be told that Heritage Turkey is the best. There's nothing wrong. And the fact that that's $10 a pound, that still should be something they strive for. It should be still a fact that they know. It shouldn't be something they dispute. And nobody, especially who writes for the Times or something like that, should themselves decide that that issue isn't important, is not important for poor people to know about. They're like, those people are poor, so we will have a different set of a different set of ways that we judge them. You know, there'll be different rights and wrongs for poor people. And if the Heritage Turkey or the locally organic grown vegetable is better, then everybody needs to be told it's better. If that's a fact, then that's what it is.
And at the end of the day, it's about money and marketing. I mean, no one really, it's easier for McDonald's and other brands to market to, you know, communities of color or communities that don't have a ton of money. So they'll market BS. And, you know, other large companies or other companies that are doing great food typically are small. They don't have the budgets to be able to do marketing. So it's small. It's small things that people like Paulin and Kim Severson can do to basically get the message out to the masses. Mm-hmm. So I do feel like if you're in a position of power and you're talking about food and people look at you as the voice of the food movement, it's very important at every breath that you talk about the small producers like Heritage Foods USA and all the folks around the country and in Brooklyn that are doing great stuff around food, good food.
Yeah. It's just, you know, in Europe and Carlo Petrini, who founded Slow Food, he was always talking about quality. That's what people need, because like a quality prosciutto, you only need a quarter of a pound and it fills the whole family up. Quality is also not always an opinion. Like some prosciuttos are just better than others.
Yeah.
And even though one person or 10 people might like the weird one, if it's just an established great prosciutto or great cheese, for instance, like Anne will tell you, that cheese is not that good, you know, and it's trying and it can get there, but it's just not that good. And that is a truth. It's a, you know, gastronomy is like psychology or like sociology. It's a science of sorts, and there's rights and there's wrongs. And that's just a fact. And so I think it's actually very, I don't know what the word is, you know, it's very prejudiced against people.
Oh, it's semi-racist.
It's semi-racist, you know, just to say,
classes.
For you, the broad-breasted. No, it's for the whole world, the heritage, if you can afford it. But to pretend that that's not true, I've never really understood judging people on a curve or treating them differently just because they're poor. I mean, they should be called the same thing. And, you know, everyone is just striving for them to have the iPhone and to travel and to wear nice clothes. Why all of a sudden with food is it outrageous
to think
about spending $70 for a 15-pound turkey?
I will say my colleagues in the good food movement, we talk a lot, and I'll say we. I try not to do this, but we talk a lot about wanting change, and we want mass change, but as soon as a little bit of that comes out, we trip out. I mean, I'm not a fan of Walmart. I said it a million times on Hot Grease. But if they want to bring heritage birds to the masses... Isn't that what we want?
That is what we want. Now, let me ask, is there food quality in your neighborhood?
I live in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. For folks who are listening or not in Brooklyn, I mean, it's probably one of the cultural meccas for black folks in actually the country. It's becoming a very gentrified neighborhood. There are tons of great restaurants that are opening. You and I were talking earlier about Saragina Pizza. Mm-hmm. There's Do or Dine. There are a lot of places that are selling local food. But in terms of shopping... there is not a place to shop. The only grocery store in Bed-Stuy is Food Town. They do sell organic products or products that you wouldn't normally find in just a traditional Food Town. But I will tell you, it's like $1, $2 more. What the heck? You know, I mean, it's like...
But would it be $2 more at the Whole Foods?
Of course not.
Uh-huh. So they... Because that actually supports your infrastructure, your structure talk.
Exactly.
Because there's no structure, so therefore it's out of whack with the rest of the country in terms of, you know, how high it should be cost.
So if you have a family of four and you want to go to Food Town because you don't want to trek way to Lower Manhattan to Whole Foods... And you want to go to Food Town and pick up your stuff. Well, I mean, you're going to spend, if you buy, say, almond milk because your kids are lactose intolerant, you want to buy King Arthur flour, you want to buy some organic fruit, you're going to be paying like $8 to $9 more than what you would pay at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
$9, you can buy like some meat or something.
So do people eat badly in Bed-Stuy for the most part?
I would say no. I would say that Park Slope Food Co-op, which is a co-op, one of the nation's largest co-ops in the country, over 3,000 members of the co-op live in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Huh.
So you have 3,000 people going outside of the neighborhood to shop at a co-op that has great food at a very reasonable price.
What about CSAs, farmers markets? I mean, how is that penetrated? And not just your neighborhood, but other, you know, neighborhoods that are not, you know, on the in Midtown Manhattan, for instance.
I would say if you look at neighborhoods all across the country that are similar to Bedford-Stuyvesant, you'd be surprised to see that there are CSAs. There's a CSA in my neighborhood that's been around 7 years. Other neighborhoods across the country, that folks think people don't want fresh fruit or vegetables, they have successful CSAs and farmers markets. They just don't get a lot of publicity, or people are not writing a lot of articles about them. And they have, you know, 100, 200 people that are buying food or getting food every single week or every month.
Well, very interesting. So I know we're going to come back after the short break and talk about Occupy and food. And I want to ask you, Nicole, what you think they should be fighting for.
Occupy, okay, yeah.
And then we'll talk about hot grease. And then we'll cut to a clip of an old farmer from Kansas.
Ashamed, and I will only tell you one more time than you know that I'm never gonna tell you again.
All right. So tell us, Occupy, where, by the way, this is the main course. We're engineered and produced by Jack Inslee. I'm Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's live, 261 Moore Street, unless this is being listened to later, then it's not live. But
before Occupy Wall Street, I have to ask you guys, did you buy anything for Black Friday?
I did the small business Saturday. What's that?
Awesome.
The shop small Saturday.
Cool.
I Black Friday, it's just the whole, that's also a big employees thing. People talk about how big companies treat their employees. Like, forcing your employees to get there at midnight for what? Best Buy needs to do what on Black Friday? Come on. They can open at 9 a.m. like everything else. They'll still probably make $50 billion profit. I don't know. It just seems upsetting. Those poor workers.
Yeah, I worked retail all during college and even as an adult part-time. It sucks.
It's just like a marketing mechanism to create a frenzy of purchasing. Also, wasn't Black Friday originally like when people would buy their Christmas gifts and then hide them for a full month?
Yes.
Who hides gifts for a month anymore? You know, it just seems bad all around, you know, and I actually don't think that the economy is judged or depends on that one single day.
Well, supposedly that was the day that the big retail folks went in the black. That was the day that they made all their money on that Friday.
Well, one thing we can all agree on, this has been a Turkvember to remember. Let's talk about Occupy and Big Food, talking about corporations and that. I mean, that's been a big, you've been one of the big proponents of getting the voices of Occupy Wall Street onto Heritage Radio Network, especially as it relates to food. So tell us a little bit. You had one of the chefs on, right?
So I had Amy Hamburger on the show. I mean, that was like as soon as Occupy Wall Street happened, a few weeks after. It's a great interview. The tons of people came to the site and retweeted it on Twitter. So Amy came on to talk about how they're feeding people. And so after the show, I went down to Occupy Wall Street to try to see Amy in the flesh. I didn't meet her, but I was there 2 hours just observing them giving food away. And I took tons of pictures. I will say that there are a lot of homeless people and people who are hungry getting food at Occupy Wall Street. There was a lot of big food down there in terms of peanut butter, granola bars, but there are also folks bringing like carrots, fresh fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. I think I've been very vocal on the show and outside of the show and even on Twitter and Facebook, because I've retweeted and did a little commentary about Occupy Wall Street. I think that Occupy Wall Street is a very young movement. I think that mainstream America supports what they're doing, but people are confused because it seems like right before Thanksgiving, it turned into fuck Bloomberg, you know, that they just got away from the whole thing that they were striving to do, which is for folks to think small in terms of business and who you support. And it was all about, we're going to get Bloomberg. So I was turned off by that because I'm like, okay,
you thought they were misguided.
I think that they're a young movement and they're trying to figure it out. And they're using the approach of, we don't have a leader. We want people who are a part of the movement to make decisions. I mean, if you've seen their assembly and how they make decisions, it's a very slow process. As a person who's an activist and who's worked in nonprofit, I get it. I get what they're doing. But I think for them to bring in mainstream America, they are going to have to really, really have a list of demands or suggested mm-hmm. things.
Well, I always say all good ideas are killed by committees. But, you know, at the same time, you know, it's like this is a voice, a movement of the people. So what would be some of the three or four things that you would put top of the list of demands for Occupy Food?
I would say small. I mean, we mentioned CSAs before. I think that the CSA model being replicated and government putting more money, particularly if you look at the farm bill, let's get into the farm bill and pick out some demands from there, such as supporting CSAs and farmers markets and putting more money so communities that don't have them will be able to have them. That's first. I didn't see anything in their demands, their original demands about the farm bill.
Yeah, well, the farm bill, and then, well, what about this? Like, let's say one of their demands was that big companies have to treat their animals humanely, and, like, they all companies have to be certified humane or better. Let's say, and that increase the price of, you know, meats by $1 a pound. I mean, would that be a good thing, or would that be a disaster?
I think it would be a good thing, but I'm going to be realistic. We know that, I mean, if you follow food policy and ag policy, are we being realistic that could happen? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, meat, the lobbyists for meat, they're huge. Can we do something smaller? I'm thinking let's go small, try to mm-hmm. make demands that are very small and that can impact people on a local level instead of going that big. But maybe they can think broadly and do something like that.
Were you inspired? Did you feel that the issues that you take on day in and day out in your work and also week in, week out at Heritage Radio, I mean, do you see Occupy Wall Street being a viable change maker for all those issues?
I think Occupy Wall Street is a viable model for people who want to make changes in their community. Because I feel like change happens on a local level. Mm-hmm. I'm not inspired by the loosey-goosey the loosey-goosey, we're just down here drumming on drums. I'm all for that. I think that's great.
I have nothing against drums.
No, I love drums. I mean, but at the end of the day, when I went down there, it was like, oh, God. And maybe because I'm an activist and I've always worked in nonprofits, so I've been doing the work, like, hands-on and also the strategic piece. And I know how long it takes to get an idea out and happen and make things happen. But I'm inspired by what this big movement can inspire in local communities, in small communities all over the country, to really create change, not just to say we're mad and we're protesting and we want to change, we are the 99%, but we are the 99% and this is what we're going to do.
Very interesting. So, well, let's talk about, as we wrap up, I mean, Hot Grease then and now. Are you on your 88th episode?
Oh, really? Is it 8? I know I'm coming up on 100. I am...
Jack, what is it? What's, let's go to the videotape. Fact checker.
Yep, we're going. Hold on. Next episode will be episode 90.
Oh, wow. So wow. 10 shows. You know what?
I must have missed one along the way. Sorry, I thought you only did 88.
I must say I am truly grateful to come into the studio at Roberta's, the Garden of Roberta's, every Monday at 3:30. And to do the show. I mean, I'm grateful to you, Patrick, and to Jack for giving me the opportunity to talk about food politics and also to talk about lighter things on Hot Grease. Southern food, biscuits.
Red Velvet Cake, our top-rated show of all time.
Yeah, Red Velvet Cake. I mean, I love being able to bring folks in the studio who are not the big-name Michael Pollans, but folks who are doing work in their small community, who are making jam. So I'm excited.
Now, how has it changed from 2 years ago to today? Like, have you gotten better? What do you focus on now? What don't you do or what do you do? Like,
I sucked the first 10 shows. You didn't know that, Patrick?
I thought you were pretty good.
Oh my God.
Jack was outraged that he had to sit through those first 10 shows.
Oh my God. The first 10 shows. I was so nervous because I have a southern twang. I mispronounced words and I was just so nervous. I remember I came in here, Michael Crupain was my first guest and I had a glass of wine and I was so nervous.
And then I know what you're going to say. Then you listened to the main course a few times and you felt inspired. You were like, wow, exactly. I'm not that bad.
I was like, listen, that's when you had a 2-hour show then.
Oh, brother.
You had 2 hours. I listened to quite a few of the shows. Ann Saxelby is probably the show that I've been listening to the longest.
Mm-hmm.
I love Ann's show. Who else do I listen to? I listen to the main course. There's so many great shows.
But now, what are you trying to do? What would you say you've done? So you've kind of given voice to people that are often overlooked?
Without a doubt. I tell people after they leave the Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network that we have the magic dust. We sprinkle the magic dust on them because I feel like when people come through here, they leave and then they're like, oh, they're on Martha Radio next. They're in the Times. They just blow up. I look at Allison Cave. She's the owner of First Prize Pies. Her mom owns Ronnie Sue Chocolates in SS Market.
Mm-hmm.
And she came in here. Literally, she had just won a pie contest. She was not like in the Times a million times. She came in Hot Grease and next thing you know, I mean, she's big. She's on everything now. And it's so many other stories like that. So I feel like young food entrepreneurs, they come to Hot Grease and they get to
It's like
spread
a launching pad. Now, is that a threat? Like, have you ever been acknowledged by some of those other media sources as like we first heard it on Hot Grease?
Hell no.
Yeah, HRN does not get very much respect from, you know, the bigger radio groups out there. Although I do think they must look at us as a kind of pulse on the...
Without a doubt. I mean, I would have to say, Patrick, I'm going to have to pat myself on the back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably one of the only hosts that was on Twitter at first. Wouldn't you agree, Jack?
True. Absolutely true.
And so all the big name food networks, not food networks, but I will say the VP of digital at Food Network, she was on Hot Grease. They all listen to Heritage Radio Network. They know us and they listen to Hot Grease.
And even down when you were in Atlanta, right? Bill Harris and all those people, they seemed to know what was going on this network.
Yeah, I was at the Southern Foodway Alliance down in Oxford, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
John T. Edge has been on the network a million times. But yeah, I mean, these are people from all over the country who are writing about Southern food. So it was like, 500 people there? They're like, oh, yeah, Heritage Radio Network. We know Heritage. Everyone knows us.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, how would you mobilize all that energy? I mean, do you think it's just like stars in the sky? I mean, how can you turn those random stars into like a constellation that has a real, you know, forward-thinking message?
I mean, I have a few ideas. I think that... One of the things is, I hate to always be talking about, you know, people of color, but there are a lot of people of color who otherwise do not get any press. I think it's important to have a collective. So one of the ways to make all the stars align, I would love to do a collective of folks around the country who are of color to do a food collective, what you're doing, all one website. So if you're interested in spreading the word about your heritage turkeys and you want all these folks around the country that are doing food work to know about it, you can just go on this food collective and say, hey, this is my thing.
Who's your guest this week? Do you know yet?
Yes. My guest this week is the author of Tipsy Vegan. It is a book all about...
I would be tipsy too if I was a vegan.
Yeah.
I'd be drinking all the time.
I don't know why they have vegan in the title, because essentially it's a book all about foods with booze in it.
Oh. Well, vegan is not a cuisine. It's just an idea. You know, exactly. It's like vegetarianism. There's no cuisine there. Indian food. That's a cuisine.
Yeah.
And it concentrates on vegetarianism. But to
say
vegan.
It's a marketing word.
And I always remember telling Alice Waters, you know, when people would when they would ask her and I was there, your food grew out of the hippie movement. She'd be like, no. Hippie food is, hippie is a guy with long hair exactly. who smokes weed. That has nothing to do with Chez Panisse, you know, yeah. like even though it might have grown out of a counter-revolution movement, like. Their aim is gastronomy.
So I'll have to say, so he's going to be on the show, and I just want to shout out a few other people. Natalie Dupree is going to be on the show in December. The Natalie Dupree. I grew up looking at her on public TV.
That's
she
big.
Has a great book, Southern Biscuits, that's out. Sonara Weathers is going to be on the show talking about Kwanzaa.
Is Kwanzaa this year?
Kwanzaa is the same time every year. It's the 26th through the 1st.
26th through the 1st. So Always. It's like a Hanukkah. You guys,
I'm not gonna say it's like a Hanukkah.
It's like 7 days of gift giving.
If you, yeah,
that's not about
the extent. But it's not gift giving.
Oh,
yeah, it's not gift giving. So you will. We'll
I need to learn more about Kwanzaa. That's
we'll
interesting.
We'll demystify it.
Oh, very good.
We'll demystify it. So I'm excited about December. A lot of stuff about the holidays. A mixologist is coming on the show.
Okay.
Then
we have our holiday party, the HRN holiday party.
I know. Yeah. December 8th. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. So, this has been a post-Thanksgiving extraordinary show, and we're going to actually had a very interesting guest in the studio, as people might know. Heritage Foods USA is a company that moves 20 tons of pork a week from about 40 family farms, and Larry Sorrell is one of those farmers, and he has organized a coalition of 14 Amish farms to raise rare and heritage breeds for our network and the chefs that buy from us. So he was in studio. He had never been to New York before. I think he'd probably only left Glasgow County a couple times in his whole life. So it was really cool to see him here. We took him to Fatty Crab. He ate. He came to the Essex Market and toured all the stands there. So I think he had a great time. But here is a little lens into a 70-year-old farmer who raises the best proteins on the planet. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Jack. Well, we're really happy to have in studio two of our favorite farmers, Larry and Madonna Sorrell, and their two sons, Jacob and Nathan, 2 of 8. So how's it going, Larry? Thanks so much for coming to Brooklyn.
It's going really good.
Have you been mugged yet?
Not yet. I'm not looking forward to it.
If you guys could see Larry, he is got a long white and gray beard, black cowboy hat, and you know, he definitely looks like he's not from these parts. But anyway, it's how do you like New York? I mean, have you been here before?
First time. It's different.
Where were you born? You were born your whole life in the Kansas area?
Right. I've been born and raised in the same county.
Same county the whole time.
Which one
is that?
Cloud County in Kansas.
Is that near Salina? And
it's about 40 minutes north of Salina.
And what's the environment out there? Give our listeners a sense of what that county is like.
We have a really... real estate and mostly wheat and corn, Milo.
and it's generally flat there, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Now, Eastern Kansas has one of the richest soils in the world, right? I mean, the Flint Hills, and I hear a lot about just the great agricultural soil out there. Is that true?
Southeast Kansas has really good soil, yes.
Southeast Kansas. And what about where you are? What kind of soil are you farming on?
Sandy loam.
Sandy loam, is that the best?
No, it's good.
It's good. And tell us what you raise, Larry.
We raise red wattle hogs.
How did you go about and get so many of the, so high a percentage of red wattle genetics?
Well, we started out with two gilts and a boar and just totally got out of hand.
And tell us, well, Madonna, are you going to come on here at all? We got to have Madonna on. She is the mother of 8 children, 2 of which are here. What numbers are you guys?
5. I'm third from the bottom.
Third from the bottom. And Madonna, so 8 babies, is that true?
9. We have 9. 8 boys and 1 girl.
But you're done now, right?
Oh, yes. I've been done for a long time.
So tell us about you, Madonna. Where were you born? And tell us a little bit about the towns you grew up in.
I was born in Salina, Kansas. And totally, most of my life raised in Cloud County, too.
Now, Salina, Kansas is a very interesting town. They have a lot of museums out there. They have a kind of little boardwalk with, like, clothing stores and all that. It's a very nice town.
Yes, it is. Very nice shopping area.
How has it changed over the past few decades?
Oh, it has gotten quite a bit bigger. It's one of the kind of busiest towns in Kansas for population and shopping.
Okay. And what aspect of the farm do you mostly work on? I mean, by the way, you're my favorite chef of all the farms and slaughterhouses that we visit each year. It's always your pies and your simple foods are the best. But tell us, besides cooking so well, what are your primary tasks on the farm?
I'm probably what you would consider the second hard man.
Second hard man.
And it's not a good paying job.
Not a good paying job, but Larry loves you for it, I'm sure.
He better.
So now you guys don't just run a single farm, you run a network of farms. So can you explain a little bit about how that idea of a group dynamic works in agriculture in the States?
Okay, I've got several people that raise red wattle hogs for me, and I pick them up and sell them for them through Heritage Foods, and then you
in turn go and pay those guys for their work, and you work a lot with Amish people, is that right?
100%.
And how are they as a culture? I mean, it takes a long time to enter in and be accepted by that group, right?
Very, very long time. You have to earn their trust.
And how do you earn it? Do you show up at their church every Sunday?
No. You just have to be honest and do what you say you're going to do, and eventually they'll be your friends. And
very, very interesting. And who is you've created this unbelievable network now, and they're all purebred pigs. I mean, are they registered with the various groups out there, or do you kind of do your own self-registering?
Mostly our self-registering are ones that we do our paperworks on our old spots. All our old spots are papered, but other than that, we have our own bloodlines on the rest.
Mm-hmm. And you raised some turkeys this year after a while.
Yeah, we raised a few turkeys this year, standard bronze turkeys.
Because we had originally met through turkeys,
right?
And then the pig thing happened second.
Right, 8 years ago we met at Good Shepherd Ranch.
Wow, 2 presidential elections ago.
Yeah.
That's a long time. I love it that you're such a good, strong Democrat within the farming network. No, just kidding. I always wonder. I think everyone's Republican. It's funny. I work with all Republicans, which is funny, ironic, being from the city, wearing orange pants. But anyway, thank you so much, Larry, for coming on. I'm really happy you got to see this place. And thanks for all you do, not just for those farmers, but for us and all those chefs. And we should have you back on to call in and tell us what you think of all these weird restaurants and what they're doing with your red wattled pork.
Well, thank you, Patrick. I enjoyed being here.
Very good. All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.